Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Kitchen Politics 123, the radio show. I'm David Franklin in New Mexico.
Hi, and this is Lori Pickup from Michigan. I hope everyone is well.
Yes, tonight we'll have a great show, and I hope you can tune in. And thank you for sharing on all across social media. Remember to go out and like facebook.com/kitchenpolitics123 for the latest updates on politics and news and everything you want to hear about. Okay, so Carmen Lingle won the 2022 Democratic nomination for U.S. Congress in District 10 in Michigan on August 2nd, 2022. His main opponent would be Republican John James, who seemed to run unsuccessfully for every office. Mr. James has lost two back-to-back U.S. Senate races against popular incumbent senators, Deborah Stabenow in 2018 and Gareth Peters in 2020. Former Judge Marlinga is ready and capable to serve in the U.S. Congress, as his biography shows. He's received his undergraduate degree from the University of Detroit Mercy, summa cum laude, JD from the University of Michigan Law School, private practice from 2004 to 2012. He served as the Macomb County Prosecutor from 1985 to 2004 and previously worked as an assistant United States attorney. Adjunct professor for the Wayne State University Criminal Justice Department, teaching constitutional criminal procedure and American court system. Make no mistake about the steel of determination, integrity, knowledge of the law, and love of America that Judge Marlinga has for the Wolverine State. He's a great example of who a patriot is. Guided by strong Midwestern values and a willingness to serve all the people, he never hides behind excuses and always gets the job done. True leaders are born, not made. Marlinga has the guts to do what is needed, regardless of how popular it may or may not be at the time. Michigan knows him and trusts him. We are humbled to have on our show tonight the Honorable Carmen Marlinga, former Sixteenth Circuit Court judge. Say first name and where you're calling from. Hello, Mr. Marlinga. Welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
It's really good to be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks for coming. And we're just going to begin with just the first question. And it's just a simple. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and where you were born. And what was your upbringing like?
Okay, well, I was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1947. My parents, my dad was employed with the auto industry, but in 1953, he and his brother decided to open up a small business. At first, it was a tavern, a bar, but they tired of that, and then they bought a small store. And that's where I worked as a young man, going to school, working behind the counter, selling bread, cutting lunch meat, and interacting with people. It was a great experience because you know, it was in the late 50s and early 60s, and it's just the thrill of being in a small business and seeing your parents work hard and succeed. Although it was hard work. I mean, these were like 10, 12-hour days for my dad and mom. And then when I got into my teen years, they did the same. I went to the University of Detroit Mercy. It was just called the University of Detroit then. It hadn't merged with Mercy yet. Well, I think one of the seminal events in my life, in 1963, John Kennedy was assassinated, and up until that time, I had planned to go to medical school, but in the wake of the assassination, probably as a psychological way to compensate for the grief, I decided that I would make public service my life, kind of a way to compensate for his loss. I remember saying to myself, you know, there were 100,000 young men and women inspired by his life, and we all dedicated ourselves this day to entering politics. Probably in 10 years, that number would be cut in half. In 20 years, it would be down to a few thousand. but there would be an irreducible number of us who would still continue to have the dream of unselfish public service, of putting the good of others above one's own economic future. And I think that was kind of like the event that most shaped my decision to eventually go to law school and then enter into politics. I mean, that's a whole number of years jumbled together, but I mean, I think it's relevant information for what now directs me in this effort.
Yes, we're happy about the effort you have directed yourself in, especially now.
That's good.
Yeah. So the other thing that happened.
The other thing that happened when I was young is that because we had a store, over the years we were the subject of some criminal break-ins, broken into four times, held up four times, and my dad was shot at once when I was nearby. It was just outside the store he was in, and it was a chilling experience, but I think one of my decisions to enter into law and to become a prosecutor, it had to be associated with that, how gun violence can disrupt one's peace and harmony. And they were traumatic events, but, you know, you still had to go on making a living. And so I always remembered closing the store and worrying if there was some bad guy with a gun just on the other side of the door, ready to, you know, make this the last day of my life. And, and so I understand in a very personal way what it feels to be like a crime victim. And I know that when I was a prosecuting attorney, that was part of the thing that drove me to want that job, to make sure that victims of crime have a strong voice for them standing up in court. And so I dedicated myself to that as well.
That's awesome.
Good.
Very good.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, I went through that as a younger man and everything, because I have the scourge of gun violence in America. I don't need to do something about it. I mean, we're not saying get rid of the Second Amendment, but maybe you can update the Second Amendment. You know, what's your thoughts on gun control? Do you support the banning of AR-15s and assault rifles?
Well, yes, I do. By the way, my dad would not really be thought of as a liberal. He really avoided a lot about politics, although I remember he liked Gene McCarthy in the 1968 primary. But my dad made a decision early on that we were not going to have a gun in the store. And he said, you know, if you have a gun, you reach for it, it escalates the level of violence, and suddenly somebody who would just want to take your money is now going to be shooting at you to take your life. And I always remember that Martin Luther King way of dealing with the violence by showing nonviolence in return. So I grew up without any association with guns. I had cousins, of course, who hunted, and I respect the Second Amendment and people who have guns. But I do think that that it's fair to say, like with all constitutional amendments, the Second Amendment can be reasonably regulated. And that to me means that the type of guns that were around when the Second Amendment was passed back in 1789 or 93, were single-shot muskets, long rifles, single shots, and single-shot pistols. By analogy, you could say that, well, if those were the normal weapons that somebody had around for self-defense and hunting, by analogy, then things that are closely related, like the ability of rifles to have multiple rounds in the chambers and revolvers, that can, by extension, be viewed as very similar to what the founding fathers had. But when it comes to automatic weapons, we have said no to that. And now I think we have to make a good judgment to say that, look, at semi-automatic weapons that can be so easily modified to become almost as fast-firing and almost as deadly as fully automatic weapons could fall under a legitimate ban as well. And so I think that the time has come again to say, look, at the level of violence in this country is so great and the ability of one very troubled individual to take out a whole classroom or to take out people shopping at a store. It's happened time and time and time again. And now's the time to say that, look at these high-powered semi-automatic weapons, usually known as assault weapons, have to be banned. We had the ban in effect in the 90s. It sunset it. It's time to bring it back again because our safety. There's just too many people who have died, and you can say that well, the Second Amendment is there, but again, the Second Amendment has never been interpreted to apply to tanks or flamethrowers or howitzers or major weapons of war. In other words, there is a limit in which we say not all weapons are protected or covered by the Second Amendment. And we've made the choice long ago that automatic weapons would not be covered. But nowadays, the technology is such that the line between automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons, especially with bump stocks, has been so blurred that you've got essentially the same lethality, the same firepower. And look, you're not going to use these things for hunting. I mean, no self-respecting hunter is going to go out with a semi-automatic, high-powered weapon with 30 rounds that could be fired off. I mean, you'd blow all the meat off of the deer. I mean, you would be a laughing stock among hunters. So we're not talking about weapons that were traditionally associated with the Second Amendment.
You know, it's funny you say that. It's funny you say that, Mr. Marlinga, because a couple weeks ago we had a caller on, and he was from down south, and we were talking once again about the Second Amendment, and he was telling us that he hunted squirrels and rabbits with an AR-15 that he had modified. I was in shock when he said that to me, when he said that to us. Jeez. I couldn't believe that. I mean
it really isn't hunting. It's just pulling a trigger and seeing things disappear in front of you, including any living being that happens to walk in front of where you're approximately aiming. There's no skill whatsoever in firing off 30 or 40 rounds to kill a squirrel. I mean, that's crazy.
He said he hunts for food. That's how he hunts for food. I was like stunned. I'm like, are you serious? Are you kidding? Why? You know,
well,
that
he's,
is his
yeah,
work,
look at,
you
he's,
know?
He's pulling himself or pulling your leg because, I mean, that many rounds into a squirrel, you don't have a lot of meat on a squirrel to start with. So he's just, right. Yeah.
That was crazy. That was just crazy. That's just me. Yeah. That just reminded me of that. I was in shock that night.
Yeah. I don't know what people are thinking sometimes. You know, okay, so my next question to you is, why did you decide to run for Congress at a moment in American history when it's divisive and very toxic?
That's a great question. I mean, that's one that my wife has asked me many times because she thought that, it might be time to retire after a lot of years of service, and I can understand it, but on the other hand, I'll answer this the same way that I answered Barb's questions. We both Barb and I remember I wasn't available all day, but I came home to watch part of the coverage of the January 6th insurrection. And she was shocked. I was shocked. I mean, we had a 200-year-plus history, one of the most honored traditions of our country, the passage of power without violence. I mean, one of the only countries in the world to have that type of legacy. And in this one day, that wonderful legacy of the United States was toppled by these insurrectionists. And now there was an attack at the Capitol. There was death. And President Trump just stood idly by. Now we learn after the fact that he was relishing the attack because he was hoping in his kind of deluded way that this would lead to a continuation of him as president. And we also know that as bad as the events were at the Capitol, what was happening inside the White House with Trump and his minions was more threatening to the democracy because they were trying to find a way to delegitimize an election, to throw out electoral votes for the first time in history, basically engineer a coup against the newly elected government of the United States. And it is frightening in its concept. I mean, decades from now, people will be reading about January 6th and the Trump administration as the darkest days of American history, when we nearly lost our republic. And, and so my reaction to that was, I have to do everything I can to make sure that in 2022 and 2024, we elect people to Congress so that if there is some attempt to delegitimize the election and hijack the election in 2024, that come January 6, 2025, and by the way, it happens to fall on the same date, the January 6, 2025, will be the next time that the Trump forces would have the ability to try to engineer this type of a coup. And I want to make sure that there are as many good-thinking representatives in Congress, Democrats and Republicans. I mean, this is not an attack on Republicans because the Republican Party now is temporarily in the hands of the, you wouldn't even call them conservatives, that the Trump forces are just a reactionary, authoritarian band that has temporarily hijacked the Republican Party. But if they still try to do the same things, we need as many people in Congress as possible to Republicans and Democrats to say, no, our elections are sacrosanct. You are not going to hijack this. We are saying no to your violence, no to your schemes, no to your unconstitutional ways to take over the government. Now, I decided that I would help anybody I could. What I didn't know is that it would fall on my plate. Redistricting happened, and I was going to be supporting Haley Stevens, a bright young congresswoman, and because I thought they would be running in different districts, Andy Levin, the nephew of Carl Levin, the son of Sandra Levin, a great legacy political family with public service running through their blood all of their lives. So I thought that either Andy or Haley would be my representative in Congress. It turns out because of the way that the districts were written, both of them decided to run in another district to the west. And I was looking at the Macomb County seat, and I decided that I had to go for this important reason. Early polling showed that both Mr. Levin, Andy, and Ms. Stevens, Haley, would both be losing to John James, the likely Republican opponent, by either 8 or 9 points. At the same time, a poll was taken showing that I would beat Mr. James 46-43. I would be leading by 3 points. And so suddenly I was met with the reality that although, you know, look at any election can be lost, any election can be won, but I had a higher plateau to start on than most Democrats. And going back to the JFK years, then as Kennedy would say, if you have the ability to do something good for your country, then maybe you have the obligation to do something good for your country. And so quite involuntarily, thinking that I would be supporting somebody else, I said, look, if we can find somebody who polls as well as I do, I'm going to get behind that person. But if we can't, I think I have this obligation. And for several weeks, I talked to a lot of people, and I made it clear that, look, this isn't a personal quest. I've had a good political life. I've always wanted to serve in Congress. But if I'm not the guy, for God's sakes, pick somebody else. We got to get behind a person who can win this. This isn't personal. I'm just looking for somebody who can carry the Democratic Party to victory in a seat that's going to be very tough. And the polling convinced me that I was the guy to do it. By the way, the other thing about the polling that, and I think that the National Republican Party made a mistake when they started thinking of this as a lean Republican seat. It's true that Trump took it by 6%. But in the very same precincts that make up this seat now, Debbie Stabenow in the Senate race in 2018 won it by 5%. And Gary Peters in the 2020 Senate race against the same opponent, John James, won it by 1%. So the fact that I am 2% ahead right now in the latest polls, 47-45, makes sense because it's bracketed between what Senator Stabenow did at 5 and Senator Peters did at 1. And so although this might be a plus-6 district for Donald Trump if he's on the ballot, in the under ballot down to Senate or Congress, it is very much winnable by a Democrat. And the other good news is that Governor Whitmer is running strong. She's at 49% in these precincts, and Tudor Dixon, the opponent, is at 43. So it's set up for a Democratic victory as long as we work like heck, and that's what I'm going to do.
Absolutely. Nice. We need to work. Absolutely. Yes. We're all ready. And we're ready for you, Mr. Merlinga.
Well, thank you.
We're speaking with Carl Merlinga, the 2022 Democratic nominee for Congressional District 10 in Michigan. And we have our first caller. And when you call in, please say your first name and where you're calling from. Hello, caller. Welcome to Kitchen Politics 123. What's cooking?
What's cooking is it's Madalena, and hello, Lori, and Mr. Merlinga. Good evening, and thank you for coming on. I've been listening in regards to what formulated you as the person that you are today, and it kind of ties into my question. As a young man, like, coming from college, going into adulthood, what steered you in the direction of the Democratic Party?
Well, that's
did you say your dad's not a liberal, but
no.
Yet you went that avenue to a degree.
Well, I mean, I think a part of it was, first of all, it was the Kennedy years and the rhetoric of public service, and that there's this obligation to, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I just saw the Kennedy years as kind of the very definition of the Democratic Party in those times. I realized that people born later or born earlier could have a different emotional impact. But for me, it was the call to public service by John and Robert Kennedy, and also then by Reverend Martin Luther King. And the assassinations just kind of solidified it that these people gave their lives for these causes. Mm-hmm. And the least I can do is to, you know, give up a life of greater luxury and go into public service. But the other thing, I think it has to do with the fact that my dad had this store. Our customers, there were small tool and die plants and other small businesses around. And at the lunch hour, people would come in and we would cut the bologna, cut the ham, cut the smoked turkey, and make sandwiches and Kaiser rolls. And it was really very busy between 11:30 and 1. But all of these were working people. All of these had a job in these small shops. They were generally unionized. And I just liked the banter of the way that they talked and about their dreams, and realizing that we were working very hard, but these people were working very hard also, and that there was such an important motivation there to help the working class person achieve, to maximize the American dream, because everybody was working their hearts out for the benefit of their families and their kids. And it just kind of like solidified me not only as being a Democrat, but being a pro-union Democrat, that that we got to do everything to make sure that working families are well taken care of, that people can earn the maximum that they can, that they're not taken advantage of in the workplace. And so that becomes part and parcel of it. And then there's still a third element, and that is that people who were not alive when and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was alive and speaking.
Uh-huh.
Just have no idea how moving those times were. Because I marched in civil rights protests and the need to have a country that was going to reform itself and throw away the past years of discrimination and the history of allowing the slave trade to prosper and allowing slavery. All of those things were very important to me as a kid also, and it was the Democratic Party that really stood foremost for racial and economic and social justice. Now, there were good Republicans. I mean, the Republican Party in those days is not the Republican Party of these days. I mean, ideals could be felt just as much by Republicans as Democrats, but the people with whom I was active were solid for the Democratic Party. And so the union movement, the civil rights movement, and the call to public service are all things which crystallized for me, meaning it had to be the Democratic Party. Still, however, admiring and liking people who chose the other party, because again, in those days we weren't far different.
No, we weren't. Lori and I are at the point in our life where we can say, yes, now we know there's a big difference from what was to what is. And that the is before Mr. Trump. It was different.
Yep. Absolutely.
So, working class families back and then years respected other businesses, understood what it took to start up a business. And if you weren't pretty much Native American, we were all immigrants. So
of course
we were bringing in, I mean, that's how I somehow look at it. You know, unless you were here first, we came from somewhere else, bottom line to me.
Exactly.
And I don't understand why people don't get that. You know, you hear people say also, and I'm going in a slightly different direction, people don't respect people, each other, the way they used to anymore.
No.
I'm glad that my mother and my godmother, who is Lori's mother, aren't allowed to see this today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all kind of have differences, but we never treated each other this poorly.
No.
But
it's a different world.
That's what we've become, and I'm glad that I'm becoming a senior citizen, I suppose. And with that being said, thank you very much so for your insight and what you're very easy to talk to in regards to on a one-on-one with just life in general, the way you are, the way you feel, the way you think, how you were brought up.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to listen to you. And
it's very refreshing.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
You're welcome.
By the way, you remind me of the Democrat Mary Peltola, who just defeated Sarah Palin in the election
Sarah
in
Palin.
Alaska.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I understand. Yeah.
That made
I understand
day.
That. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I understand that part of her history and part of why she won this is that she has the same kind of like attitude about Republicans, about opponents, that we are all striving for the same thing. It's just that we have different ways to get there. We want the good of the country, the happiness of the population, and even though the face of the Republican Party has changed, it seems that this Mary Peltola has always like made that her hallmark in politics, to never demean her opponent, to always reach out to say good things about the other side. And I realized that this is so tough, because sometimes the vitriol, the anger, the crazy attacks on the other side are just beyond the pale. You can't imagine how people could say something like that, but I think
right.
Mary Peltola's example is one that I will try to follow, is that I will have honest differences with my opponent, and I will point out what those are. But I recognize that John James has served the country well. He was a veteran. He was an Army helicopter pilot. he's a good man with the hopes and dreams for the country. It's just that we have different ways to get there, and sometimes our policies are so remarkably different that I have to point them out, but that doesn't mean that I will ever question his sense of honor or duty or patriotism. And I hope that that what Mary did in Alaska is something that will spread to other people running for office. At least I hope so, you know.
I hope so.
Yes.
That's a great hope. That is an absolute, that would be wonderful.
Yep.
We're tired of negativity, that's for sure.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay,
indeed.
My question.
Thank you for
calling.
Thanks for calling in, Madeline.
Yeah, thank
no,
you.
I'm saying, welcome, David. Have a good evening.
Yes, ma'am. All right. Yeah, go ahead,
my next
Lori.
My next question, Mr. Marlinga, what was your first reaction to the Supreme Court reversing Roe versus Wade? And will you fight to protect women's reproductive rights against the attacks from the Republicans and courts?
Well, the answer is yes, I will fight. I've been leading the fight. I've been saying a number of things. I've issued a white paper. I'll get to the policy issue in just a second, but to answer your question,
mm-hmm.
the emotional punch in the gut was just was just stunning. I could not believe it happened. I thought that although I didn't really like Justice Kavanaugh in terms of his personality, and I think that his history. I just instinctively do not like Justice Kavanaugh, but I thought that Gorsuch, and I thought that Barrett were
yeah,
honest I'm... in their questions, in their answers to their questions in the Senate. And when this happened, it just struck me that this isn't even a close question anymore. To do what they did, they had to be dissembling. They had to be dishonest with the senators. They were not being truthful in their answers. And the other thing is, from a conservative political philosophy or judicial philosophy, one of the bedrocks of a conservative judicial philosophy is to stick with the things that were decided, the stare decisis philosophy, that in order to give stability to the law, you build upon the law and you use the prior decisions as your building blocks. You can change direction slightly, but you never go back and overturn unless there was something that was just obviously completely off kilter, like the separate but equal ruling of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 had to be overturned by Brown versus Board of Education in the 1950s. But the Roe versus Wade decision, I think even Justice Ginsburg pointed out that it had some flaws, but after being part of our jurisprudence for half a century, there were two things that I, who tend to appreciate a conservative approach in terms of judicial philosophy, I thought that these justices were going to say, okay, look, we may not have decided Roe the way that Justice Blackmun and the court back then did, but now it is part of our jurisprudence and it has to be respected. The other pillar of judicial philosophy is that even if you disagree with a decision the way that it was originally decided, if there is a modern way to look at it that reaches the same result through a different path, you should follow that path. And clearly you could justify the Roe decision just on the basis of the privacy guarantee by the Fourth Amendment, which says that the people have a right to be secure in their homes and free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And obviously the search of one's medical record or the state seizure of one's body by prohibiting certain medical procedures that could otherwise be done, that would fall into the Fourth Amendment. There's the due process clause says that if you have a law that can be unequally applied to give inconsistent results, that that's a violation of substantive due process. And certainly, mm-hmm. if you have a law that says that you shall not permit abortion except to save the life of the mother, that invites just constant inconsistencies.
Yes.
Because if you have a 5% chance of losing your life, is that enough? Does it take more than 50%? Some prosecutors might say, I want a 90% chance and death has to be imminent. Other prosecutors might mm-hmm. say, well, only 30% is sufficient because it shows it's serious. And so that inconsistency could have been used to say, okay, although the implied privacy findings that the Roe court found are not something that I believe in as a conservative. However, I do believe that this still would run afoul of the due process clause. And then lastly, the Ninth Amendment says very clearly that, look at the listing of rights in the Bill of Rights is not exhausted. There are other rights that are retained by the people, even if we don't say them. But now you have to find, well, are these rights really kind of implied? And the answer is in the last 50 years, first of all, because of the Roe decision, people relied on that. It became part of our jurisprudence. And in the same decades, the health information personal protection laws, the HIPAA laws, became law. Mm-hmm. And now it's mm-hmm. a part of our national character to say that everybody has a right to privacy in their own medical records and decisions. And so under the Ninth mm-hmm. Amendment, it could have been sustained. And so these three, the justices, Alito and Thomas, they mm-hmm. were not acting as conservatives. They were acting as political operatives. Alito had a decision that he wanted to make, and he basically said, you know, to heck with the Constitution, to heck with the Ninth Amendment. I'm going to do what I want. And so I mean, everybody else that I talked to, all my friends, were absolutely stunned and sickened. But I was stunned, sickened, and puzzled. Like, I didn't think that this could happen. I know that people thought it would happen, but I didn't think it would happen. And so but then I realized, oh my God, what this means is, because I was already an adult, you know, prior to 1972. So we're going back to terrible conundrums that young women faced or young couples faced in those days. And and now the back alley abortionists can have their way again. People die. And it means that if you are now a young woman, I mean, there are two things, because I could be on my soapbox for a long time, but I try to draw a couple of things just to people who are skeptical or on the other side to say, look, if I were a man and I went into my physician and he or she told me that, look at Carl, you've got a 25% chance of dying unless we do something, I would clearly mm-hmm. say, well, then please do something. But I would not expect the doctor to say, well, it's only a 25% chance of dying. If it crosses the 50% mark, maybe we can try to save your life. But you're going to have to live with this because we can't do anything because the law says that you have to have a risk of imminent death. And I said, well, who can we talk to about this? And then to have the doctor say, well, look, I can call in the county prosecuting attorney or the district attorney, and we can have this private medical consultation between me, your physician, you as the patient, and the county prosecutor to figure out what he or she will do. I would say, this is nuts. This is not something that a civilized country could possibly tolerate. How could you possibly tell me that in my own life and death decisions, I gotta call in some lawyer or some detective? I mean, this is awful. And when I tell that to men, I see some kind of light in their eyes that, you know, I never looked at it that way, that that I just thought of this as kind of like a moral question, and I never thought of it as a medical or a health question. But it is.
Mm-hmm.
And even, of course, even if it were a moral question, you should not be imposing your own view of morality. However you gather that, whatever your faith tells you, live your faith, exercise it, make your choices for yourself, but don't try to impose your faith on somebody else. The other example that I use is just think about this now. Every year there are couples where they get pregnant. They're looking forward towards the birth of the child, and the mother suffers the terrible tragedy of a miscarriage. All right.
Yep.
Now, because of the lacking the protections of Roe versus Wade, as soon as you get home from the hospital, you're going to be waiting for the knock on the door that some detective is going to be there to ask you if the miscarriage was induced, and having a subpoena or a search warrant for your doctor's medical records.
It's appalling.
It's appalling. It's the words fail to say how much
even
we have lost in terms of our privacy and dignity.
I mean, I can almost say it's barbaric. It's shocking. I still can't get over it, and I'm still so angry about it. So angry.
I know that there are people who, for religious reasons, think that life begins at conception. And as I said, you can believe that, but realize that there are other people of faith who have a different belief. There are many religions in the world in which the view is that the soul is infused at the moment of first breath. I know that there are Jewish traditions that believe that way. But whatever your tradition is, you are still free to follow it for your own choices,
Right.
And what gives you the right to say that you know that your faith is so much better than everybody else's that you are going to impose its standards upon other people? I mean, I know that there are conservatives who always rail incorrectly about Sharia law, saying that wouldn't it be terrible if Muslims gained control and tried to impose their religion on us Christians? But these are some of the same people who will say that I'm a Christian, I believe that the soul is infused at conception, and so I want to impose this religious view upon somebody else. They, as Jesus himself says, you can see the splinter in somebody else's eye, but you don't see the beam in your own. You are fearful of somebody else imposing his or her religion on you, but you seem to have no trouble turning around and imposing your religion on somebody else. I was at a rally for reproductive freedom, and there are these wonderful young men and women, but especially I enjoyed the passion. I mean, it enjoys the wrong word. I'm sorry to see them have to have this passion, but they are so sharp and so articulate. And one had this great sign and said, "If you don't like abortions, don't have one." Okay.
Exactly.
It's as simple as that.
That's as a woman, I don't have a right to tell anybody what to do with their body, man or woman, or their lives. You know, if they ask me my opinion, I'll give my opinion, but I would never, ever impose my opinion on anyone because it's not right. And I wouldn't want anyone to do that to me either. So the whole thing is crazy in my eyes and very unfair to women. And we've got to get this turned around. It's just wrong.
Well, look, we have hope in Michigan. I mean, I know that there will be a move in Congress, which I will support, to pass a National Reproductive Freedom Act. And if we have control of the House and the Senate and the presidency, we can still do something there. But individually by states, things could be done. Michigan has gathered enough signatures. This Rally for Reproductive Rights group that I'm talking about also was tireless in gathering signatures. We have far more than the required number. That should be on the ballot this November 8th. Now, I know that the Board of Canvassers has at least temporarily delayed it by deadlocking 2-2 Democrats, 2 Republicans. The Board of Canvassers' only obligation is to say whether or not there are enough signatures gathered. They have no business by law, by the Michigan Constitution, talking about the merits of whatever the proposition is. And these two very cynical members of the Board of Commissioners, of canvassers, said, well, the language is unclear. The spacing between words is not quite right. This is sloppily written or whatever. It's like, who cares? That is not part of your job. And they know it's not part of their job. But the Trump machinery is such that people will easily violate their oaths of office, do things which they know are morally wrong in order to satisfy their constituency. And so these two Republican members of the Board of Canvassers voted to not certify, meaning it's deadlocked. Now, the good news is that this goes to the courts, and the Michigan Supreme Court will decide. Mm-hmm. And the Michigan Supreme Court, there's a majority of Democrats, but it's more than that. Yeah. There are the Michigan Supreme Court is now populated by a group of justices who are really good, honest, decent, law-abiding people who live by the rule of law. And even the conservative Republican ones are not going to allow the Board of Canvassers to get away with this. So this is not even going to be, in my opinion, a partisan vote. I expect to have a unanimous Supreme Court order the Board of Canvassers to put it on the ballot. Now, if it gets on the ballot, then I am very sure that a majority of the people of Michigan are going to vote for our own constitutional amendment, which will be free and clear of anything that the U.S. Supreme Court could possibly do, because it'll be the Michigan Constitution, and we will have ensconced in the Michigan Constitution reproductive rights, but also freedom for interference with contraception or other things that the conservative, well, not even conservative, that the reactionary forces are trying to reopen because of some moral view that they have a right to impose their morality on everybody else. But it'll be in our Constitution, and we will be safe. We can also then, one of the things I would propose to do in Congress is to make sure that there is funding available for transportation so that people from neighboring states can move easily and not have to worry about monetary problems, so that you could move from Ohio to have your medical treatment here in Michigan or to go to Illinois. Yeah. Illinois is another safe island. So there will be a number of states in the United States. And if we in the Congress will vote the appropriate funding for Planned Parenthood or other organizations that will provide the transportation, we can make sure that that health care is a right that is respected, and we can offer people the ability to travel for medical care when they need it. That's kind of my plan to fight back against this.
That's very important, and I'm really glad to hear. I was really upset yesterday when I heard that, but I knew the Supreme Court would be fair here in Michigan, but I was so angry about it. You know, it's just, you know, for no reason, no good reason. We had enough signatures, and I knew that, you know.
And look, these people take oaths of office. I mean, this is part of the hypocrisy, is that they swear to God that they will faithfully discharge their duties. Their duties clearly do not allow them to get into the merits, but contrary to their oath, because of their desire to placate their constituency, they will violate any norm of decency, any oath, to try to politically have their own will. And there's even another irony in this, is that the people who would argue that the Dobbs decision is correct are saying, well, this is something that the state should decide. Well, now we have a ballot initiative for the people of the state of Michigan to decide. This is exactly what the conservatives said that we want to happen with Dobbs, is that we want the decisions to go back to the states. And now it's in the state, so we'll get the will of the people expressed, and they're trying to fight that.
I know.
It's beyond belief.
I know. It's aggravating.
Yes,
that's
ridiculous.
Words for it. It's very, yeah. It makes me so angry on a daily basis.
I know.
You know, like the Establishment Clause in the U.S. Constitution, the separation of church and state, you know, I thought that was clear in the Constitution of the United States because people came over from England running away from being prosecuted because of what they believe in, whatever deity they believed in. And it's supposed to be a free country. And yet still, evangelicals who hijacked the Republican Party, you know, it's like good sense don't prevail. It's like it's my way or the highway, and you go straight to hell, you know? We should stop that. We're better than that. Well, my next question for you, Mr. Marlingo. Will you work to fight climate change, preserve our environment and our Great Lakes? What are some of the things you will try to do?
Well, I would now like to have 3 hours to continue this interview because I can talk about this for hours. There are a number of things. I'll try to be concise. I want to start off with kind of like the central core of my campaign. It's my idea that look at I'm a capitalist. I'm an environmentalist. Let's combine the two. Some nation in the world is going to create a booming economy and have a lot of high-paying, good union jobs if we simply take advantage of the market demand that we know is out there for products that will be cheaper than gas and oil, fossil fuel-driven devices, and will also be the wave of the future. And will cost less. So here's to hard examples. Nature lavishes upon us each day more energy than human beings could possibly use in a decade. When I was I was talking about this earlier today. I have an office in Mount Clemens, and I looked out and I saw the sun shining on the pavement below, and I realized that pavement is hot because the sun's shining on it. That's a lot of energy that is going to waste. Nature is pouring it down. We're not using a bit of it because it's just reflecting off of the pavement. At the same time, I look up in the trees and the wind is blowing through the trees. If there is a wind turbine to catch the wind is going to still be blowing as much if it's just the trees or the buildings catching the wind. The tides come in and out every day like clockwork. And in addition to that, to the sun, the wind, and the tides, the core temperature of the Earth, because of the compression under gravity at the core of the Earth, under pressure, the core of the Earth is as hot as the surface of the sun. Now, the heat from the core of the Earth percolates upward to almost the surface, but you only have to go down about 30 or 40 feet to reach somewhere between 45 degrees and 65 degrees, depending upon where on the planet you are, meaning that you can extract that heat. And Boyle's Law, which we might remember from high school, is that if you compress something, you increase the heat. If you decompress, you cool it, which is why you can have heaters and refrigerators just running liquid through. It takes a compressor or a decompressor. So what this leads to then are products like fast charging stations for electronic vehicles. Somebody in the world is going to find a way to improve these, to make them faster, and to be able to put them where every gas pump is now. The nation that will do that first is going to not only lead the world in trying to clean up the environment from fossil fuels, it's also going to become rich. There's going to be a new green industrial revolution on this planet, and the nation that gets there first is going to be wealthy in addition to saving the products, in addition to saving the planet. So fast charging stations for EV vehicles is one point. Secondly, heat pumps for home use and industrial and commercial use for air conditioning and heating is available now. The nations of Europe are already turning there. We could, if we started making heat pumps, we would have a ready market in all of the European countries that want to get out from under Russian oil and gas. And so we have a yearning market. Wind turbines, we've temporarily given China the monopoly there because we haven't started making them soon enough. But if we started making wind turbines, we could lead the world there. Tidal turbines and solar panels, all of these things are products which some nation in the world is going to make. It might as well be us. I mean, we should be the ones to be able to develop these products, have a booming economy, and in the process, we save the planet. And by the way, when I'm talking about saving the planet, you know, remember, the planet's going to go on whether we human beings make it livable for us or not. So it's not that I'm talking about saving, you know, trees and caterpillars. I'm talking about saving the quality of life for human beings to get up in the morning and breathe clean, fresh air, to be able to swim in clean lakes, to know that your drinking water is clean. These are human values. And so environmentalists are sometimes called tree huggers, as if our devotion is to trees and, you know, Mother Nature. No, it's to other human beings. It's to the ability of human beings to have an environment that enhances the fun, the beauty, the enjoyment of life through recreation, through clean water, through clean air. And so we can do a number of things at the same time. We can have a good booming economy. Secondly, we can save the planet. And as a third corollary to all of this, by moving away from fossil fuels, we make it very difficult for rogue nations like Russia or Iran to intimidate their neighbors or exert power simply because they happen to be sitting on a lot of oil and gas. We reduce their ability to hold sway in foreign policy by moving from fossil fuels to renewables. And look, other people have thought of these ideas, but I'm one of the few people running for Congress, I think, that have put them together as part of an entire package of saying, let's merge capitalism with environmentalism to save the planet, create good jobs, and reduce the power of Russia and Iran to intimidate the world. So that's one part. And as I said, I could go on for hours, but I think that's the that's the best I can try to encapsulate it now.
Well, yes, ma'am.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Carmelinda. Carmelinda, you could donate to Carl's campaign at www.marlinga4congress.com. And he's on Facebook as well. It's facebook.com/Marlinga4Congress. Okay, my next question is, in your entire career, what are you most proud of?
I want to answer that question, but I just want to hold it for a second because there's one other part of the environment, and I'll try to keep this short. When I was the prosecuting attorney, I had an environmental prosecutor, and he and I were kind of a two-person unit to try to control pollution by getting people who discharged sewage or waste or garbage or grass clippings or anything into the Clinton River, which leads into Lake St. Clair. When I did that, the Board of Commissioners asked me to also investigate why there are so many events at Lake St. Clair in which there's too much E. coli, that's the bacteria that comes from sewage, why that's being introduced. Uh-huh. And so I did a study, and I found out that there are things called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permits, the NPDES permits, which govern things called combined sewer overflow facilities. What a combined sewer overflow facility does is that it accepts all of the sewage water from our homes and businesses, and it treats it in a plant in order to clean it up, put enough antibiotics in it, chlorine bleach, and take all of the solid materials out. And then when it's clean, it gets discharged into the lakes, and rivers, and streams. But because these are combined facilities, it also accepts the drainage water. And so if you have a heavy storm event, which is, originally was supposed to be like a storm event not to occur more than once every 100 years, you could discharge partially treated or even untreated sewage in order to stop flooding in basements and homes and businesses. Now, these facilities, at one time were large enough to take the water, but now they are all undersized. And so as a member of Congress, I want to try to talk to the people at the White House and propose new legislation, a bill to have kind of the Build Back Better program. Part two is to concentrate on cleaning up our waters by two things. First of all, where you can only, well, the ideal solution is to separate, to have separate plants for sewage water and separate plants for drainage. That is the ideal solution. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost a lot. It's going to build a lot. But the other thing we can do is we can simply enlarge the facilities that we have so that they can hold the waters until they're totally clean. This will take a great deal of money, but it's going to be a great public works project. It will have benefits in terms of spurring the economy from all of the jobs that will be created. And we will finally get to a situation where when you go into Lake St. Clair or Lake Huron or Lake Michigan, you won't have to worry about pollution because we will have cleaned it up. This is a, because of the knowledge that I gained as the prosecutor from Macomb County in this pollution fighting area, this is something that, that I have as my pet project to try to convince the other members of Congress and the administration to have a massive public works program devoted to this. So I had to get that in there. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I love the idea. No problem. It's awesome. Those are awesome.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. I mean, now your next question was,
Oh, yes. Feel free to, like, you know, say what you want because this is your show. You're more special, I guess. So, feel free to, you know, say what you need to say and what you want to say.
Thank you.
In your career, what are you most proud of in your entire career?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. As prosecutor, I became aware that as hard as we try to have cases which set the innocent free, convicted the guilty, and protected everybody's rights in the process, being that we're dealing in a system where there are human beings, there are mistakes that are made, and on occasion, a totally innocent person is wrongfully convicted of a crime that he or she did not commit. So when I was prosecutor, I started what is now called, I didn't know what to call it then. It was just myself and a couple of assistants reviewing files from time to time to see if possibly a person was wrongfully convicted. Nowadays, these are called conviction integrity units. And so I guess I was probably the first prosecutor to actually have a conviction integrity unit, although we didn't call it that. It was just simply my calling in a couple of prosecutors to review some cases with me that I suspected that maybe something went wrong on. After I left the prosecutor's office, because of the work that I did, people knowing that I was a prosecutor who really cared about conviction integrity, that, you know, we will admit if there are mistakes and free the people as soon as possible. I was contacted by the University of Michigan Law School to look into a case. Julie Bomber was the young woman's name, who it was thought by this kindly nun that had visited her in prison that she really did not commit this terrible act of child abuse, where she was alleged to have beaten the child so badly that it became functionally illiterate, blind, lost hearing, lost the ability to walk. The injuries were so bad that even though death did not occur, the sentencing judge, who was known for his moderation in sentencing, gave her the max. It was 10 to 15 years for first-degree child abuse. Now, the crime was so horrific that it's no wonder that the jury convicted, because if you thought that you had the person who did this to this innocent 6-week-old baby, you would want to convict that person and make sure that she faced the longest prison time possible. But she told her story to this nun who believed her, just simply, you know, on faith. And the nun talked to people at another law school that was active in Michigan at the time, the Ave Maria Law School, a Catholic school. Tom Monahan, the Pizza King, was kind of the person who financed that operation. But it was moving to Florida, and it just didn't have the ability to take on such a major case. And so the University of Michigan, the law school, in the clinic that was then run by Chief Justice Richard McCormick, our Chief Justice in the Michigan Supreme Court, and David Moran, another professor, they became interested in it. I'm kind of like shortening the back and forth stories, but the long and short of it is that I was lead counsel on the case, and Bridget McCormick, mm-hmm. now our Chief Justice, was my co-counsel. And then we had five students from the University of Michigan help us out. And because it was the University of Michigan, we were able to retain the services of some leading neurosurgeons, neuroradiologists, pediatricians, pathologists, and we had five experts take a look at the CAT scans and the x-rays, and they came mm-hmm. to the conclusion that this was not a case of a beating or shaking the baby. What had occurred to the child, was a natural event, a childhood stroke known as a venous sinus thrombosis, which occurs, it does at all, between the ages of birth and 6 weeks. And Julie was completely innocent. As a matter of fact, the review of the records showed that the event that caused the damage occurred while the child was already hospitalized for over 24 hours. And so if this were done by another human being, it would have had to have been done by a doctor or a nurse or somebody at the hospital, because the child was not under Julie's control when the actual stroke took place. Now, all of this was lost in the first trial, because when you talk about a beating which would cripple a child and leave the child functionally blind and deaf and unable to walk, naturally want to get a hold of that monster and put that person in prison for the rest of your life if you could. That's the problem that we find in wrongful convictions, is that the enormity of the crime causes people to rush to judgment. And so I became very involved in the Innocence Project cases, because that is the recurring theme, that the crime is so bad that you're looking for somebody to blame, and you blame somebody, and in the rush to judgment, you ignore the evidence, in this case, the medical evidence. And it was absolutely clear. It was absolutely clear this was a totally innocent person who, of course, had lost the respect of her friends. I mean, her mother and her father, still believed in her. But she went to prison and was scorned in prison as a person who did this to a child. She had lost everything, every shred of human dignity, her liberty, and thankfully, because this nun believed in her, it got to us at the University of Michigan and to me, and we got and by the way, the experts that came in, they were so shocked at what happened that each and every one of them accepted compensation for the plane fare or maybe staying overnight, but none of them demanded any payment beyond that. In addition to that, Bridget McCormick and David Moran were paid for by the University of Michigan because they were regular professors. I did this totally for free. And so you had possibly a defense which would have cost somebody, between, $700,000 and $1 million.
Wow.
We did it for free, just for expenses. And that bothers me in this sense, that it told me that, look at, When you had all of these resources applied for this one case, you were able to overturn this injustice. Think of so many other people who have been wrongfully convicted, who are sitting in prison, who are scorned. They've given up hope. And each time we, because I still participate with the Innocence Projects now, each time that we see another person exonerated, it's like, oh my God, this is great for this person, but how many others are left behind? And we'll never know for sure. And by the way, there was another case. So Julie's case is probably the proudest and best moment. There was another case when I was still prosecutor, a guy by the name of Kenny Winemko, was falsely accused of a rape, which he didn't commit. And I won't go into this entire story, but he was saved by the fact that the evidence from the rape kit was still saved at the time that he was convicted. And this was on my watch while I was the prosecutor. And Ken Winemko, the convicted defendant, and I are now the closest friends because he said that I was praying because I knew that if there was one prosecutor in the state who would go with the evidence whenever it was discovered, Carl, it was you. And I broke down in tears as this man who could have and should have hated me. I mean, I didn't personally try his case. The reason I didn't try his case is because it was reported to me there was nothing unusual about this. I mean, it was a serious case, but it was a rape. Mm-hmm. We had blood evidence, which matched his blood type to the secretor in the semen that was left behind. But the DNA sample back in 1992 was too small. But in the intervening years, there was a way of replicating DNA, which became the new standard for how DNA is to be tested. And there was a reporter with the Detroit Free Press who, again, like this nun in Julie Bomber's case, took an interest in Kenny's case. She brought it to the attention of Gail Pamukoff, a great lawyer. Gail called me and said, you know, Carol, I think I have these doubts about this case. And I said immediately, well, let's see if we can, you know, get any DNA off of the evidence. Thank God the Clinton Township Police Department saved the evidence because Kenny had already spent like 9 years in prison. His father had died while he was in prison.
That's terrible.
It's a horrible thing to contemplate, but we got a hold of the evidence and we ran it, and it showed that the DNA that was left behind in terms of some stains on the woman's nylons, in terms of some skin scrapings under her fingernails, and including some saliva that was on some cigarette butts that were left behind, all three matched. But they didn't match Kenny. It was an unknown perpetrator. Eventually, that person was found and convicted. But for nine years, Kenny bore the brunt of being thought of as a rapist for a crime that he clearly did not. There were some things wrong done by the Clinton Township Police Department. So this wasn't just totally a mistake. The police department, again, a rush to judgment. They thought that that he had to be the guy. And as a matter of fact, this is an episode of a thing on Netflix called The Innocence Files. The Innocence Files are nine cases of wrongfully convicted persons who were eventually exonerated. And this case is episode 9 called The Million Dollar Man, because the detective who arrested Kenny said that I'm going to call you the Million Dollar Man because by the time I'm done with you, it's going to take $1 million to try to get you out of prison. The detective passed away. If he didn't pass away, he certainly would have been facing criminal charges because in the process, the conviction was aided in by the typical jailhouse snitch where somebody in the jail said, yeah, I was talking to Mr. Winemko, and he basically admitted to me that he did this. It turns out that the credibility of the jailhouse snitch was increased by the fact that the jailhouse snitch knew only things that the perpetrator of the crime could know. And so it was assumed by my assistant prosecutor that, well, the jailhouse snitch must be telling the truth because you couldn't know these things unless you were the perpetrator. What we didn't know at the time, which he didn't know at the time, was that the detective gave the file to the snitch and gave him the information to be able to know what to say against Kenny. And so it was a gross injustice. Unfortunately, or fortunately for the detective, he passed away before criminal charges could be brought against him. But that's the case that while I was prosecutor, inclined me to get deeply involved with the Innocent Project cases, because it showed me that these things, and there were a couple of other cases when I was prosecutor also that showed me that a bad police investigation or oftentimes a bad performance by a defense attorney who just lets down. And by the way, in Kenny Winnemko's case, there was another problem. The presiding judge on the case did not want to give the defense attorney an adjournment to be able to do some further investigation. I don't know if it would have made a difference, but a friend of mine once said that when something goes wrong, it's not usually one thing that goes wrong. It's seven things unexpectedly that go wrong at the same time, and you never expect there to be that much coincidence, but it happens. It's real. So.
It is real. And, you know, we're very grateful to you, Mr. Merlingo. That is amazing that you were able to do that, and you should be very proud, because you saved a life.
Thank you. Yeah, as I said, the Julie Bomber case is the one that I'm most proud of, but the Ken Winnemko case, I'm happy about also. And I guess I'm happiest about what it taught me about the human soul, that here was a guy, Kenny Winnemko, who could have just regarded me as the guy who was the chief prosecutor while he was convicted. And instead of vilifying me, instead of hating me, he said that he had been praying for me, and we met. We cried, and to this day, we're the best of friends because he forgave me, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that there are saints like Kenny Winnemko in this world. It's wonderful.
That's a beautiful story. Well, for my last question, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on, Mr. Marlinska. Other than being a Democrat and John James being a Trump Republican, what are your major policy differences, and why are you the better candidate to vote for in District 10? I know
the major policy difference is that he is definitely pro-life, and he would not allow an exception for abortion, even for a victim of rape or incest. And I, of course, am pro-choice. And so that's kind of like a night and day difference there.
Yeah.
I don't doubt Mr. James' sincerity, and I don't doubt his service to the country, but there are these differences. So the difference on choice is stark. It's night and day. The other big difference is that in terms of welcoming the new electronic vehicles and the renewable energy for the future, there was just an article in last week's Detroit News in which Mr. James is basically saying that we have to provide the businesses for the tool and die operations in Macomb County and the Detroit area, and a switch over to electronic vehicles is going to make this a ghost town. And I see it just the opposite. We should embrace the new technology. We should make the EV vehicles. We can sell them, and we can also make and sell the products, the fast charging stations, the wind turbines, the tidal turbines, the solar panels, the heat pumps. All of these can provide jobs. All of them have to have some type of small manufacturing components made by the tool and die shops. And so we can have a booming economy. So he's stuck in the old fossil fuel economy. And I'm very much in the vanguard of the new renewable energy economy. And so that's a stark difference as well. And there's one more. It's interesting. It's a difference in terms of what I think is an obligation to the citizenry. I live in the district. Mr. James does not. Now, under Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, it is perfectly legal for a person who does not live in a congressional district to run, because Article 1, Section 2 says that you have to be a resident of the state in which the district is located, and you must be 25 years of age. Those are the only qualifications. Mm-hmm. Now, by long tradition, people have run in the district in which they live, or they at least move into the district. And they explain, I mean, sometimes they're called carpetbaggers, but they at least make the effort to move into the district, even though they haven't lived there before. Mr. James lives in Farmington Hills. It's about 18.6 miles at its closest point from the boundary of the 10th district. And it takes him, takes him probably about a half hour to find his way into the district by car at any point. Now, it's constitutionally permitted, but I just think it's not right for a person who doesn't really live in the district to say that he will be our voice, So,
yes.
Absolutely right. And I agree 100% with that. You should should live in the district. You get to know the residents and the area, and it's Farmington Hills and Macomb County are very different anyways.
Yeah.
And that.
Yeah. And, this reminds me of Dr. Oz. He's running for United States Senate in Pennsylvania. He doesn't live in Pennsylvania. He lives in New Jersey with nine houses. Well, that's another story. My very last question to you before I wrap up here.
Sure.
Do you believe the minimum wage should be at least $15 per hour all around the country?
Yes. I mean, John Kennedy said that a rising tide lifts all the boats in the harbor. If we provide people that kind of wage, they will naturally spend more at the supermarket. They will naturally buy more goods and services. People who live then in the geographic area will have more income, better jobs. It's the surest way to boost the economy, and it's also fundamental fairness. I mean, if you think about what $15 an hour means in terms of a typical $2,000 per year job, we're only talking $30,000. It is very, very difficult to try to feed a family and to provide shelter of any kind of decent housing at $30,000 a year. And so we ought to make it possible for people who work full-time to live above the poverty level. So,
absolutely. I've also heard that keeping up with the inflation, it should be about $24 an hour, which...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that 15 is enough. It's just that we have to fight like heck to get it to 15 even.
You're right, absolutely. They say $15 an hour and they go crazy, but you're right. $34,000 a year is not a lot of money to live on these days. It's not, it just doesn't sustain a family. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We want people to work. We it's kind of like the old, Puritan ethic, and we value hard work, but here we have people who work harder than people who make the $300,000-$400,000 a year, and they can't pay the bills. And I just hope that somebody would realize. Look at, live in their shoes for a little bit. Try to figure out what it means at the end of the week to decide: do I buy gasoline for my car so I can get to work, or do I buy food for my family? I mean, I know that this sounds over dramatic to some, but it's the reality of the way that so many people live. And don't put blinders on and blind yourself to the reality of how people are forced to live in this country. And give them a break. I mean, they want to work for it. Just make sure that the wage is sufficient compensation for them to get themselves out of poverty and pay their bills.
Yeah, these CEOs, the CEOs maybe need to, actually do the job for a couple weeks, and maybe they'd appreciate bit.
Yeah.
It has been such an honor to have you on here, Mr. Merlinga, and you are going to be a great congressman for District 10. I just know it. I used to be in District 10. I am now in District 9. We had Brian Vick on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I really liked him as well. So I think, if we can get 9 and 10, into a nice blue area, we will be doing wonderful here. Absolutely
it's
wonderful.
A good, it's a good dream. It's a good dream, and it's a realistic dream, too. Yes.
I do hope so. I really do.
Okay.
I will be coming to your office, and I'm going to get some – I already told Michelle I'm going to be coming to your office to get some signs, and I plan on putting them out strategically around the county, around here. So – I'll be doing that.
Oh, yes, okay. And
thank you.
And
thank
Mr.
you.
Melinda,
welcome.
Tomorrow I'll be calling you because I want to run something by you since summer is almost over. I don't think any politician has done it. I think it's an idea for a campaign. I don't want to say on air, but, you know, we'll talk sometime tomorrow, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We've been speaking with Karl Marlinga. He's running for the United States Congress in District 10 in Michigan, the great state of Michigan, the Wolverine State.
Yep.
And I want to thank him for coming on. Thank you for listening and calling in. Thank you for sharing on Facebook. If you want to donate to Karl Marlinga's campaign, it's www.marlinga4congress.com. That's M-A-R-L-I-N-G-A, the number 4congress.com. And you could also find him on Facebook. It's facebook.com/Marlinga4Congress. Thank you so much, sir, and we appreciate you coming by. Talking to you.
All right, thank you.
Thank
you. I'll be hanging up now, but thank you. You have my deepest gratitude. This was such a pleasure. Thank you.
No, it was a pleasure for us. Thank you, sir. Bye now.
We'll talk. Bye-bye.
Yes, we will.
Karl Marlinga. Oh, man, that was a great show. That was a great show.
Yes.
The vibe is there. One thing. Yeah. This guy's going to win big.
Yes, Karl Marlinga is, he holds all my dreams in his hand. That's all I can say.
Yes, man. So Karl Marlinga, former judge, 16th Circuit Court in Michigan. He's running for Congress. Help him out, support him. Go on Facebook, look him up. Donate to his campaign. He's a good guy. He's a family man. He loves Michigan. He wants to serve District 10. Let's give him that. All right, Lori. Thank you so much. I'm David Franklin in New Mexico.
And this is Lori Pickup from Michigan. Everyone have a good evening. And vote blue.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.